I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on The Best of Think, growing up in the heart of New Orleans, in the kind of neighborhood tourists don't visit and nobody writes songs about. We'll spend this hour with writer Sarah M. Broom, whose National Book Award-winning memoir describes a childhood as the youngest of a dozen children in a ramshackle yellow house her mother bought at the age of just 19.
When you are the baby of 12 people, so many people are perpetually telling you the story of yourself, right? Because there are so many things you don't remember. And it's a strange position, I think, to be in, especially when so many people have come before, because you have these grown versions of who you might become one day.
Our Best of Think conversation starts after a short break. When Sarah Broom's college friends asked her to send back pictures of her hometown, she obliged with postcard-like snapshots, Bourbon Street and Café du Monde and street jugglers on stilts in the French Quarter. She didn't take photos of the yellow shotgun house where she grew up, the youngest of a dozen siblings in New Orleans East, a once up-and-coming and then struggling neighborhood where tourists did not go. She didn't bring friends home either, not wanting them to see the many home improvement projects her late father started without quite finishing. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. More than a decade after that house was scraped from the land in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, it still looms in her memory as a kind of emotional and historical touchstone in the life of her family. Sarah Broom shares her memories of the place she could not share while it was still standing in her new memoir, The Yellow House. She joined us in August to talk about it. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
You write in this book that you have always dwelled on absences in your life more than presences. Why do you think that's the case?
You know, I think it has something to do with the way things come into focus when they're missing. I think we have a human tendency probably to take things for granted. And for me, that's really true. The moment something is gone from the landscape or a person is gone, everything comes into focus. I think in a way, absence and loss reprioritizes things. And that's certainly the case for me. And I really can dwell maybe too much on what's missing or what's gone. And my eye is always drawn to the hole in the landscape. You know, I'm always wondering what was underneath that or what used to be there. It's just my tendency.
You yourself are essentially absent from like the first third of the book when you're giving us the stories of your parents and their extended families. Why? What did you feel like that history had to do with you and who you are? You're writing in some cases about people you never met.
You know, that felt absolutely necessary for me to start the story before I'm technically in it. I think part of that is that I actually feel that the story begins long before we're actually on the planet. I don't feel that any of us are suddenly dropped down, you know, magically. And so it was really important for me. This book for me is so much about context, about what leads to a certain moment. And so for me, to not talk about my grandmother or to talk about her mother or my own mother really was to, in essence, take myself out of context. And I think for me, context, to be out of context feels like a form of displacement. So it was really important for me that I begin the story before I was technically in it, to try to map out all of what the world before me was like and what things went into making me the person I am today.
I wonder if that's also a facet of being the youngest child in a very large family. I mean, you couldn't have escaped this idea that there was a lot of history, a lot of events that happened before you were on the scene.
That's true. You know, I think when you are the baby of 12 people, so many people are perpetually telling you the story of yourself, right? Because there are so many things you don't remember. And, you know, it's a strange position, I think, to be in, especially when so many people have come before, because you have these grown versions of who you might become one day. and you have 11 versions of them. I mean, one clear example is that, you know, my oldest brother was born in the 40s, and I was born, and then we had a kid born to every decade, and then I appeared, you know, right before the 80s.
Like literally on New
Year's
Eve. So
that's an enormous
Eve,
amount
right?
of history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So your mother bought the Yellow House long before you were born, long before it was actually yellow. It was in this once new subdivision that was supposed to kind of represent the future of New Orleans. Tell us a little bit about how New Orleans East, this neighborhood, was marketed to people.
So New Orleans East, just to give a sense of geography, is about 10 minutes from the parts of New Orleans that most people know, the French Quarter and the Garden District. It's the Ninth Ward, which is where New Orleans East is bifurcated from the rest of the city by the Industrial Canal, which is a navigation channel that was dredged in 1923 to connect Lake Pontchartrain and Mississippi. So New Orleans East is eastward of that channel. And New Orleans East was a place that was heralded as a new frontier, as, you know, it was going to be this incredible community with 200,000 people living in it, where there was great jobs and economies. And NASA was there, right? My father worked at NASA. My brother to this day works at NASA. It was boom time. It was, you know, there was so much possibility and so much hope. So this is around maybe the 60s, right? Late 50s, 60s. A corporation, New Orleans East Inc., appeared on the scene. And they were going to add so much life to the plans that were already underway. And, you know, many of my siblings did grow up in a New Orleans East that reflected that. You know, they had malls to go to and skating rinks, and there were drive-through movie theaters. Over time, that dream completely died with the oil bust and with white flight. But what I'm interested in my work is to try to get beyond those sort of big words, like divestment, for instance, and really give a very human portrait of how the view outside your window changes when these things happen to a neighborhood and to a community.
So the house and the neighborhood had gone through a lot of iterations before you sort of became part of the story of either one of them. I had a college roommate from New Orleans. I'd never heard of a shotgun house before I went home with her for the first time. So for people who don't know what that means, can you describe the architecture?
Sure. So a shotgun house is a, I think they call it a railroad house in New York. It's where each room leads to the other. There's no hallway. So you pass through the living room to get to the kitchen and the kitchen to the bedroom. And it's, you know, a house without privacy. In later years, my father added on a piece to the back of our shotgun that was a second story that only ran the length of one room in the very back of the house. That made our house what you call a camelback shotgun house because it has a kind of hump at the back. And that actually created privacy for my brothers who sort of lived in the room. But all of the rest of us were in a sort of communal space downstairs.
You were 6 months old when your father died, so you have no firsthand memories of him. But one of the things you know is that he was pretty much always working. Was that about necessity and the demands of, like, keeping a large family fed? Or do you think it was some aspect of him that kind of made him a person who could not sit still?
Maybe a little bit of both from what I hear. And this can only be from what I hear, like you said. But I think also he had an enormous family. And he was a family man. He loved his family. And he was also a musician. So I think he had a kind of need to play music. That was maybe the thing that he did, the same way my mother was a seamstress. But I think he also just had to do side hustles with my siblings just to provide. And I know that it wasn't easy.
So he died young, but he was an older father to you. He died of natural causes. Did it ever feel like abandonment that he wasn't there, even though you knew what had happened to him?
You know, that is so confusing for me still. I think because I was raised surrounded by so many brothers. It didn't hit me so sharply. When I was in my early 20s, I was driving in the car with one of my older brothers, Byron, who I'm very close to. And I remember just turning to him. Something hit me, and I turned to him and I said, "What's the difference between a brother and a father?" And I just saw the shock on his face because I think for him, he hadn't put it together, right? That I had this sort of gaping absence that I never talked about. And I just remembered him struggling to find language for, because he was then a father and is now a father. And I was wanting him to explain to me how those two things were distinct. And just seeing him struggle for words was also interesting to me and profound to me.
You got really good at observing the conversations of adults in order to understand the world. You didn't necessarily maybe always interpret everything correctly, but like your family called you tape recorder.
Right. And we see that has served me well, by the way. When I came back many years later with an actual tape recorder. I was obsessed from a very young age, you know, with hearing the grown-ups tell stories, which I thought were so fascinating and intriguing. So I'd hide under the table or in the closet and sort of record verbatim in my head all of the more interesting bits of the story. And then I would essentially run off and tell the wrong people whatever they had said so that no one would talk anymore around me, which is not different, by the way, from my life now among my siblings. Every time they talk to me now, they go like, this isn't going in a book, right? I think I was interested in this world, and I grew up around these people with enormous voice. And I love the way, for instance, my mother, you know, she puts together sentences in a really poetic and interesting way. I think that's how I came ultimately to be a writer, listening to those stories and listening to my mother talk.
Speaking of names and nicknames, we should say that Sarah is not what your friends and family who knew you growing up would call you. They use your middle name.
Yes. And that was always something that mattered in a private way to me, that in a way, you know, I guess what I mean to say is what name someone called me by helped me understand their proximity and relationship to me. And so if someone called me, you know, Mo, there was an instant feeling of intimacy and closeness. And then my other name, Sarah, which sounds foreign when I say it about myself, actually, was a sort of public name. And, you know, and the moment that this all coalesced for me was when I was really young. It was the first day of kindergarten, and we'd shown up to school. And I had suddenly a, you know, a little mat that you sleep on during your breaks in my little backpack. And it had the name Sarah written on it. And I just remember thinking, who the heck is Sarah? And my mother telling me, when the people at school ask your name, be sure to tell them Sarah, not Mo. And I thought, but I am Mo, right? And so that began this kind of dichotomous self.
My guest is Sarah Broom, and we're listening back to my conversation from August about her memoir, The Yellow House. When we return, Broom talks about rethinking her relationship to New Orleans.
I feel that in certain ways, you can be native to a place and still buy into certain stories of the place. And that's the thing I now resist.
That's when The Best of Think continues. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Sarah Broom, who joined me in August to talk about her book, The Yellow House, which went on to win a National Book Award. Let's return to the conversation. back to the Sarah versus Monique, certainly it tells you how people feel about you, how well they know you. Are you different when you're sort of inhabiting one name versus the other?
I think I'm the same. There is a kind of doubleness and a duality that I think is an old story. You know, it's what Du Bois wrote about. And there is a way that I think I am as Sarah that is more, a little more officious, you know, a little more sort of composed and controlled. And I think when I become Monique, which is generally around my family, I have a different positioning, which is also natural in any family, right? But I'm free in ways that I otherwise might not feel so free.
You have a lot of memories of the Yellow House as a studious house. Your mom is studying for a nursing license. Your next oldest sister, the one that you most grew up with at home, is attending this school for gifted children. You became obsessed with playing school as a kid. What did you like about that?
Well, I liked bossing people around. That's number one. Okay. I'm a Capricorn, and I hear Capricorns generally like that. But then also, I love the idea of, I was sort of imitating school. And in school, we took all of these strange standardized tests that were, you know, A, B, C, D, or E. And I was, in a way, replicating this structure, this choreographed day that I would have. And, you know, I would go through and fill out the answers myself and then grade them, right? So I was in a position of power while also kind of being the student. And it was just so much fun. I also really love the smell of paper. I still do to this day. And I loved feeling and touching it. And it was such a tactile way to be in the world for me.
So after your sister went off to college in New York, you kind of started skipping school and got into a little bit of trouble. Your mom puts you in this Christian school attached to a mega church where you were one of only five black students. And then suddenly you become aware that, like, your mother's car is new, but it's not as expensive as those of your classmates and that sort of thing. And was this when you started to think, oh, I can't let people see where I live?
I think the beginnings of that feeling were there. You know, I'm really interested in what happens over when you start to cross distance or close distance, right? So suddenly when I was going to the private school, rather than walk to school with all the kids on, you know, the side of the street where I grew up, who were the people I loved, I was suddenly being either bused, right? So I was either taking the bus or my mom was driving me. And that drive was over a long distance, you know, so we'd go, let's say 15 minutes, 10 or 15 minutes. But the idea that I somehow was going to school now in a different neighborhood, in a different world, in a way, created a tension inside of me that at the time I didn't quite understand to be a kind of pull between where I lived and where I was from and the place where I spent now most of my day.
In the mid-90s, you say your most important jobs around the house were keeping your grandmother who had dementia inside and keeping your brother Daryl out.
That's true. So my grandmother had gotten dementia and was in the stage where she was just trying to escape to meet various people, most of whom had already died. And that was a hard job for me to just try to keep her safe. And then around the same time, crack was ravaging our community and so many others. And unlike the moment now where there's this great attention to the opioid epidemic, I didn't feel that that was actually happening. Mm-hmm. There was a sense of not caring at all about what was going on. And my brother was addicted. And he was, you know, sneaking in and and stealing things and selling them for drugs. And this was enormously difficult because we're a very tight family. And that was a key moment for me as I was becoming a young woman. So his action created a kind of fear in me and a detachment, I think, between us. And that's a moment that I talk about in the book as also teaching me a lot about the limitations of home and what a house can actually protect you from or not.
Hmm. Yeah, you say it was really hard to even write that you were afraid. I mean, I think most people can understand it, and we should say your brother did, you know, go through recovery after that time. But why was it painful to admit that you had been afraid of him?
A fear is hard for me to process sometimes, mm-hmm. and to contend with. And I think for me, it shows up in so many different ways. I think, for instance, fear and shame are often twins. And because we were and are such a close family, it felt unusual and just weird to be afraid of someone you knew so well and loved so much. And so I couldn't figure that out, and I felt guilty on some deep level about it. How could you possibly be afraid of your brother, right? Feels like a contradiction, but he was scary at the time for me.
So you go off to college at the University of North Texas, which two of my kids go there as we speak.
Oh, great.
But when your friends were curious about, you know, you being from New Orleans, which I think to people from lots of other parts of the country is such a fascinating city, what you gave them was kind of the tourist version when you described it, when you sent back pictures. Why do you think you edited on their behalf when you hadn't actually spent all that much time, like in the French Quarter or whatever?
I think during the years when I was in college, I myself felt that the New Orleans that people wanted to hear about was the sort of mythologized part of New Orleans, that when they imagine New Orleans, they imagine the French Quarter and they imagine the Garden District, right? That they weren't thinking about New Orleans East. And so this is why I interrogate myself the way that I do in the book, because I feel that in certain ways you can be native to a place and still buy into certain stories of the place. And that's the thing I now resist, right? I have made a book that expands the story of New Orleans to include me and my family. But at the time, I let the city stand in for me. I let the city, in certain ways, speak for me.
Hmm. And how often do you think the city tells its own stories, and how often are those stories told by people who come in from the outside and think they know what New Orleans is?
Well, I think New Orleans is the kind of place that acts as a kind of cipher for people. Hmm. They go in, and then the city just becomes whatever they need it to be for them. And I think that's partly because it is, in fact, an enormously sensual place. It's probably so sensual, just full of the senses, the smells and the music and what it sounds like and the texture of the air. There's something special about it, absolutely. But it's also deeply unknowable and deeply dysfunctional in certain key ways. And I think most people just want the first layer that I talked about. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily willing to interrogate, well, how does this place become like this? Or they're not, for instance, paying a lot of attention to the people creating those sensory experiences for them, the people working at the hotels and the people cooking the food, right? And I was really interested in what does it mean when you work in the French Quarter and then you leave and you go home to a falling down house? What's that experience like?
Let's go to the phones now. First up, we have William in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, William.
Hi, Chris. I wasn't planning on calling in, but I couldn't resist because there's so many similarities that I have with Ms. Broom. I'm from Virginia originally. I come from a family of 11. I'm the youngest. I'm a Capricorn. My father died when I was 6 months old. And so there's so many similarities, I just couldn't help but call in. Our family is coming to terms, finally, with the loss of our father after all these years. And I'm wondering, and my older siblings especially, have dealt with issues of shame and things related along those lines. But I'm wondering, has your family come to terms with the idea of losing your father as a traumatic event?
Thanks for calling.
Well, William, I just have to thank you because you actually made me in that moment feel much less alone. So thank you for calling. And what you ask is such a good question. I don't know that, you know, there are so many, and you understand this, there are so many other people to be speaking for, so that's impossible for me to do. But I don't know that we've actually contended with that loss as a kind of central loss. And I think for me, that was the profound moment when the house was gone. I realized that the way that I knew my father, the way that I had come to know him, was through the house, right? Because the house actually bore his traces in the most direct way for me. And then suddenly, when the house wasn't there, I felt completely scattered and as if I had lost every vestige, right, of him. And I wonder how much, you know, the interviews that I did with my family and then now the kind of repetitive talking about the book, which is a different thing, have sort of made us think about what my father's loss and what that absence meant and how it sort of became part of us in some key way.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So you lost your father, you lost a house after Hurricane Katrina in your early 20s. You lost a really close neighborhood friend who'd been like a brother to you. In every case, these are like things that you should have been able to assume that you could go back to, right? Like there was no reason to think that you had to hold those last interactions precious or consider them special because you didn't know they were the last ones.
Sure. My childhood friend Alvin was central to my growing up life. And what made the loss of Alvin so deep for me was that I had left home, you know, to go to college. And I can't overstate how awful it feels that I was the rare person to leave home, you know, to go to college or go anywhere else. I mean, that was a huge thing for me, and I recognized it in the moment that I was leaving Alvin and leaving the street and leaving the people I knew and going elsewhere. And so I was obsessed at the time with all of my, I loved school. I loved learning. I was obsessed with it. I was in the UNT library for like 7 hours a day or something ridiculous, okay? And I was not thinking about Alvin. I was not thinking about the yellow house I grew up in. And so it was shocking to me the day my mother called me and told me that Alvin had died. I suddenly felt once again the distance between us and that, and wanted very badly to close it, but it felt too late somehow.
So you were not in New Orleans when Katrina hit. So like thousands of other loved ones with ties to the city, you had these like horrifying days of trying to get a hold of all the people you loved who had been there. Can you talk a little bit about trying to sort of take in the magnitude of what had happened from a distance?
It was really hard. I was living in Harlem at the time, and my sister, Lynette, my older sister, lived three houses down. And that was actually useful because we could just be at each other's house as much as possible. It was, you know, I was overwhelmed by the feeling of helplessness, that there was absolutely nothing I could do. And, you know, there were so many people we were trying to track in those days. Critically, my grandmother, who had by now been in a nursing home, we had no idea where she was. My mother had called before she evacuated, and they said that my grandmother would be evacuated. But we had no idea if that had in fact happened or where she had gone. And so, you know, we were contending with six or seven or eight people really being scattered, and that feeling of just being overtaken by a profound loss that you didn't even know the name of yet, mm-hmm. was the thing I thought about, you know, every single moment of every day.
And you were also wondering, like, did your grandmother have any kind of lucidity surrounding this? Was she protected somehow by her dementia? Did you want her to not know what was going on, or was there part of you that wished she sort of understood? I don't even know how that would feel.
It was a question I thought about when I was thinking about crossing state lines or leaving home for a woman like my grandmother, who felt so grounded and knew she was a New Orleans person. And I thought a lot about what it would mean if she had no consciousness of crossing state lines, or what it would mean if she was hyper aware of that. And I don't know that I arrived at an answer, partly because I think the questions are more important than answers. That's one thing James Baldwin said that I love so much. And so I didn't feel the need to arrive at an answer.
My guest is Sarah Broom, and we're listening back to our conversation from August about her memoir, The Yellow House. When we return, Broom talks about the connections we have to the places we live.
Who of us has not lived in a house and loved a house and felt tethered to place in a way that is unexplainable, really? That's about feeling and soul and heart. And I truly believe that houses are witnesses to our lives, that they tell stories.
That's when The Best of Think continues. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Sarah Broom, who joined me in August to talk about her book, The Yellow House, which went on to win a National Book Award. Let's return to the conversation. So, Sarah, I mean, the hurricane really kind of forced your family into diaspora, right? You had had a number of siblings living in or near New Orleans, and then suddenly there were only two in the state of Louisiana. Neither one was in New Orleans. How did it shape your sense of where you had come from when you didn't have a home to go back to?
Well, that was massive for us, because one of the key things, sort of tenets of our family, is that we would gather every holiday, mostly, you know, in one place. And generally there would be seven people, let's say, already in New Orleans. So there were maybe five of us or four of us coming from elsewhere. And so after this displacement, this forced displacement, the sort of centrifugal balance or force was just completely thrown off. So it became really hard to get together. In fact, even to this day, I can count the number of times all of us have been together at one point, just because it just became a logistical difficulty.
It seems like that's the thing that people don't fully understand if they haven't dealt with a loss like this, that you can restore people to, like, decent housing somewhere, but there's so many intangible things that are lost that it's impossible to replace.
Impossible. And then also, you know, I know this firsthand because I moved back to New Orleans in 2008, so a few years after the storm. And, you know, the house that I was renting in the Carrollton neighborhood had been renting for about $800 less than what I paid when I moved back. So the other thing that's happening is that people who can't afford to be there can't return even if they want to. Right? Because things have also shifted economically speaking. And we know, you know, history tells us that generally people poor people who have difficulty leaving in the first place are not going to be able to come back and pay, you know, $1,200 a month for rent.
Did you feel like an outsider when you came in and you did have that kind of money to pay for rent?
You know, that's a good question. I felt privileged, certainly, but never like an outsider in New Orleans. Mm. But I certainly understood that it was special that I could come back and that I was in a position of privilege that many other native New Orleanians weren't in. You know, some of my siblings weren't in that position. They were still displaced at that point and coming home a lot to try to find work. And I just want to say this brings me back to a kind of crucial feeling I had from the moment I left home and left the street where I grew up, which was trying to reconcile the self that leaves and the self that wants to always feel tethered. That became for me a kind of central question of my life and then, of course, of this particular book. But, you know, if you most want to be known, you know, how, but you're different, how do you reconcile that?
I think there are also things we can't understand about where we're from and who we're from unless we get away.
That's true. I think distance does give perspective, and distance is crucial. I think distance also isolates in certain ways. And for instance, one of the things I come to when I'm working on the book is that I only knew the headlines of Alvin's life after I left, right? During the phone calls that I had with, you know, people in the block or Alvin himself, you know, he only told me about the big moments. I didn't get to sort of know the granular detail of what made his world. And that was the crucial thing. That was the loss, ultimately, for me, was that I didn't have, you know, a intimate relationship with him where I really knew what his life was like.
It doesn't sound like you had a lot of people that you talked to for this book sort of arguing at one another through you. But maybe that happened and you just don't reveal it here. But, I mean, how invested were people in making sure that you understood sort of, not that this is a conflict-filled book, but making sure that you understood events through their perspective?
Well, the sort of interviews were crucial for me. Mm-hmm. I went down in 2011 and spent a year in New Orleans. And every single day of that year, I met with a family member or someone from the neighborhood where I grew up and did, you know, hours-long interviews. And by the end, I had hundreds of hours of interviews that I transcribed, a large chunk of them. And people's stories throughout were sometimes different. Right. And I could tell that someone was really wedded to a certain narrative. And sometimes I was wedded to a certain narrative. A story someone would tell me would completely conflict with the story I had told myself. A good example is I had been going around telling the story that I was born in Charity Hospital, which is like a very well-known sort of central hospital in the business district of New Orleans. And Charity, you know, everyone wants to be a Charity baby. But I was born, you know, in Methodist Hospital on Reed Road in New Orleans East, which was a far less sexy story in my mind. And so, you know, I had to be open to the moments when a story, when I had the story wrong or when I was telling myself a myth, really.
You wanted your father to have had a jazz funeral.
Yes. That, you know, also a very good story to have.
Right.
You know, and my father was a musician and was a jazz guy. But I was sort of annoyed with my mother when she told me that they had, in fact, called her about this. And she said no, she didn't want a jazz funeral. I thought that detail would change something about my own narrative.
Why did she not want it?
I asked her that. I think at the time she was overwhelmed. Everything was just too much for her.
Mm-hmm.
And she saw the jazz funeral as yet another detail. And she couldn't sort of deal with it at the moment. You know, she had a lot of children to take care of, and I was a baby.
The other thing that's really interesting to me about reading this story is we get just little glimpses of other members of your family. Not little glimpses, but this is all really, you know, much of it is through your perspective, your eyes, which is understandable. And I just thought about all the stories you revealed to us that were maybe a glancing part of your understanding of the world and central to someone else's. So your sister, for example, was in this terrible accident as a child. They didn't think she would recover very well. She did. And it just made me think about the nature of even within the same family, we can experience the same event and have it mean such different things.
That's true. You know, the story of my sister being hit by a car was one of my growing up stories, right? That Karen was hit by a car and she was essentially a miracle. So it was interesting to then go and try to find the detail of that particular story and to, for instance, not just interview people, but try to find the medical records and try and go to archives and see if there were any newspaper articles about it, about that one moment. And then realizing that I would have to rely in some way on the oral histories of the people who were still alive and still living. And so it's true that in a way, so many people have different memories of that single moment. And so what I tried to do was to go around to my family and fill in the gaps of information and say, okay, do you remember this moment? And if not, what do you remember? And try to get as close as I possibly could to the event as it actually happened.
Does a project like this make you question all the history you read elsewhere when the authors of those history couldn't possibly have reached the level of granular detail you did, and yet you still find yourself kind of dealing here and there with facts that didn't line up?
Yes, I think it's really hard, and that was part of the drive for me to make a more layered and complex story. You know, I was not only layering city history, I was layering family history, I was layering American history, and trying the whole way to fact check as much as I could. So a good example is my childhood friend Alvin. I had it in my memory that he was in a car accident right at the corner of where I grew up. And it wasn't until I went into the archives that I realized that wasn't true. That, in fact, he was on Chef Mentor Highway, but he was quite a while, you know, quite a distance from where we grew up. And so the work was enormous of doing the research and doing the fact-checking and checking not just the big details, but the small details. If my mother said, you know, we were on St. James Street in 1955, I would literally go and find the city directory for that year and look up my grandmother's name to find out if my mother was in fact living there in that year. So it was quite tedious.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's return to the phones. We have Art in San Antonio. Hi, Art.
Hi, I'm glad I'm on the phone with you guys. I have a very interesting story that correlates with everything of the Yellow House. Well, my dad just passed away in July. He's been battling cancer he did battle cancer for 8 years. He got cancer 2010, outlived it to the max. You know, he had good benefits. And since his passing away in July, me and my brother kind of came back to the house where he lived. We're growing up, we got our careers and stuff. But we kind of are holding on to the house at all costs with our power just to hold on to the presence of our dad.
Well, I really am sorry for your loss, Art. It sounds like that's something that you might relate to, Sarah.
Oh, I completely understand that. This is what, for me, is the innate power of the story I'm trying to tell. You know, who of us has not lived in a house and loved a house and felt tethered to place in a way that is unexplainable, really. That's about feeling and soul and heart. And I truly believe that houses are witnesses to our lives, that they tell stories. And so when any kind of disaster happens, whether, you know, it's Art's father dying and sort of, or an environmental catastrophe, I think so much about the houses that are left. And when the house is, of course, gone from the surface, I wonder about the history of places. And so that just moves me so much, Art. Thank you.
So for years, your brother took care of the yard where the Yellows' house had stood, even though the house itself was gone.
Yes, that was my brother, Carl, who is just someone who really reflects the things my mother taught us, which were that you always took care of the thing that belonged to you. You know, she instilled in us this sense of and love for beauty. My mother made a world inside this house. She sewed the curtains. She switched them with the seasons. She made doilies for the tables. And, you know, we were all polishers and waxing everything. And Carl understood that lesson. And that was the house he belonged to and grew up in. And when it was gone, I think his way of contending with that loss was to go and every single day after work, go to the lot where the house used to be and sit there and cut the grass and sort of tend to it and make it his own. And so for me, Carl was doing a powerful revolutionary thing. And he became for me the heart of my own relationship to the place and the book, too, I think.
Sarah Broom joined me in August to talk about her book, The Yellow House. Since then, the book has won a National Book Award. And I thought we'd end today's show by listening to a little of Broom's acceptance speech. She saved the end to pay tribute to her brother, Simon, who died the day after The Yellow House was published.
And yet, and somehow, and still, in the interstices of time, I have listened a million times to his hesitant voice on the recordings that we made so that I might make this book. His saying, "You grew up on Wilson Avenue in the East, baby. You can handle anything." And on the recording, he is also telling me that sometimes I talk too much, which is what I am doing right now. But I just want to say, somehow, and still, even with and through it all, the work stands. Nothing can stand in for it, I have learned, because the work is the work is the work. And this honor will buoy me as I make the next one. Thank you.
Sarah Broom accepted her National Book Award in November. The podcast of today's show and all of our shows is available on our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.